open. Though she thought it ridiculous that Raxel insisted on staying awake, she had promised to rouse him before going to bed. She bent over the sleeping figure on the couch and looked down into his face. He looked so peaceful when he slept. He never looked thus when awake. Now that she had an idea of the demons that plagued him, she could understand why. But she hoped, for the past 90 minutes, his mind had been weary enough to give him nothing but blackness. "Mr. Raxel," she said quietly, "I am retiring now." He did not move.
Julia considered leaving and telling him she'd try to rouse him, but that he would not wake. But she had promised, and she had not tried very hard.
"Mr. Raxel," she shook him a bit, "I am retiring now."
Nothing from him, not even a change in his even breathing. Goodness, but his shoulder was firm. Her hand wandered down his bicep, and even under the thick wool of his coat, she could feel the hard outlines of his muscles.
"Mr. Raxel,"
she sat on the edge of the couch and bent closer.
"Major."
That did it. He made an unintelligible sound and his hand reached out and wound about her waist. His eyes still did not open. Julia tried to pull away, but he was holding fast, and she feared if he let go suddenly, she would fall to the floor.
"Major," she tried again, "wake up."
"Not now, sweetheart,"
he muttered. With a shock, Julia realized he must think she was some sort of trollop. He must think she was in bed with him and wanted him to wake for carnal activities.
"Lie down."
He tugged her, but she resisted.
"Major, it is I, Lady Juliana. Wake up. I'm going to bed."
He moved, turning more fully on his side. The action pulled her down, and when she got her bearings, she was tucked against him on the couch. Her back was to his chest, her legs dangling over the side, but his arm was clamped around her middle.
"Sir,"
she hissed. When there was no response, Julia thought about elbowing him in the abdomen. That would surely wake him, but then she stilled. Why exactly did she want to wake him? No one could argue she hadn't tried to wake him. If she stayed here, he would get more sleep. If she stayed here, she could spend a few hours being held by a man and no one would ever be the wiser. It wasn't likely she'd ever have this opportunity again. After the business with Viscount Lanesborough, she knew she would never marry, and for a woman like her, that meant chastity. When would she ever have the chance to lie in a man's arms after tonight? When would she be able to feel the steel of his muscles wrapped around her, or the solid warmth of his chest? He would relax in a few moments and release her, then she could move safely away, and he need never be the wiser. No one need ever be the wiser. The parlour door was closed and the entire house was sleeping. She'd done nothing for herself since Harriet had come home. Couldn't she be forgiven for giving in to this one small urge? Julia closed her eyes and snuggled back against the man holding her. Just for a moment, she pretended he loved her and that he held her thus every night. She imagined this was their house and the children here, their children. It was a house filled with laughter and happiness and family. She'd had a life like that once. She'd had a family, before it had been ripped away from her, not once, but twice. All she could do was imagine what it would be like to have that again. Of course, she knew she could never have it with Raxel. What did an illegitimate son know about family? He was as unlikely as she to ever marry or become a parent. The difference was, he did not want a family. He'd made it clear from the beginning that he saw her and the boys as a burden. She would always mourn what she could not have. His hand tightened around her middle, and she closed her eyes and allowed herself to sink into his warmth and security. The sound of the cannons firing was relentless. Portugal. That's where he was. A well-aimed cannon blast shook the hill, and Tiberius reared as dirt flew at them from a few feet away. Neil lost his hold and toppled from the saddle, landing on his side and rolling to stand again. He slapped the horse's rump, a signal to depart, then pulled his pistol and fired at the first French soldier coming for him. With no time to reload, he raised his sabre and charged into the thick of the French infantry. As the first and second dragoons crested the hill, the French fought harder, knowing to give any ground would mean retreat. It seemed hours had passed as Neil fought. His sword arm ached, his shoulder screamed, and he blinked blood out of his eyes. He wasn't certain if the blood was his or the spray from one of his casualties, and he didn't take the time to wipe it away. Every fallen redcoat might be Christopher. He took foolish risks, looking down at the bodies instead of in the faces of the enemies. Fatigue weighed on him like a waterlogged greatcoat, pulling him down and down. The 16th is coming! The 16th is coming! He had to hold out until the rest of the regiment arrived. Finally, when Neil feared he could not raise his arm one more time, he could not cut down another living, breathing man, he heard the roar of hoofbeats. The ground shook beneath him. The French commander called for retreat, and Neil sagged as the enemy melted away. The dragoons thundered past him. Neil stumbled to a man wearing the insignia of the 2nd Brigade.
"Lord Christopher, is he alive?" he panted, his breath burning in his lungs.
The man, more of a boy really, shook his head.
"I don't know, sir. I haven't seen him since we last stormed the hill."
Neil stumbled away, his eyes on the fallen infantry, looking for Christopher's golden blonde hair. Men with brown hair, black hair, grey hair, and dark blonde hair lay with unseeing eyes or clutching bleeding arms or legs. One man held a hand over a gash across his middle, keeping his intestines from spilling out. Neil couldn't let himself see this, couldn't allow himself to believe any of it was real, else he'd lose his breakfast and his faltering courage. Neil trudged through the pools of blood, halting at the bright cap of blonde hair lying in one of the bloody puddles. His breath caught and his belly tightened.
"Chris," he said hoarsely, turning the man over.
His heart pounded wildly, his vision dimmed, but when he opened his eyes again, the man he touched was not Christopher, not his brother.
"Water,"
the man croaked. With shaking fingers, Neil unfastened his canteen and pressed it into the man's hands. He moved on, moved down the hill, his eyes scanning for that crown of bright curls.
"Please, God, no."
He almost passed another man with blonde hair. This man's cap was still on his head, his face obscured because he lay face down on the hill. Neil did not want to do this, did not want to see the dead face, but he had to know. He'd go mad otherwise. Neil got behind the body, dug his heels into the steep slope for purchase, and flipped the man over. Shock and pain stabbed through him as he stared at the face of Christopher Raxall. He hadn't really expected it to be him. He hadn't been ready. One green eye stared up at him, seeing nothing. The hole where a musket ball had entered stood in place of the other eye. Neil turned to the side and retched quietly. Then he sank to his knees and lay in the mud and the gore beside his fallen brother. How he wished the dead man had been himself. Neil knew it was a dream, but he couldn't seem to wake, couldn't seem to rouse himself from the soft, warm bed. It was like climbing out from under a mountain of blankets. Finally, he forced his eyes open and frowned in confusion at the unfamiliar room. Then he looked down at the unfamiliar body pressed against him. It was female. He knew that much, but he wasn't in the habit of spending the night with women. He tended to wake screaming, and guests seemed to find shrieks in the night off-putting. The smell of roses and the copper hair spilling over his chest left no doubt as to who he held in his arms. As soon as he realized Lady Juliana, he had certainly earned the right to call her Julia now, was sleeping beside him, he remembered his trek to the Draven Club the night before, returning to find her waiting for him, and that she'd promised to wake him after an hour. The weak light slanting through the windows of the parlour told him what he already knew. He had slept all night, not merely an hour. Had she slept here with him? And what the devil was that pounding?
"Juliana Rose, open this door right now," said a voice from the other side of the door.
The aforementioned Juliana Rose faced him, her cheek buried against his chest. She stirred and then snuggled closer to him. Neil had the mad urge to tell the person at the door to go away, but that would only cause more trouble, and he knew there would be trouble. No one but someone familiar with Lady Juliana would refer to her as Juliana Rose. That meant it couldn't be the cook or the maid, and Neil wouldn't be able to dismiss the intruder and make this all go away.
"My lady," he said, voice low, "you have a visitor."
She murmured something unintelligible and closed her fingers around a button on his coat. How had he slept so bloody well when he still wore his coat and boots? He'd barely loosened his cravat, and he couldn't have had more than 4 or 5 hours of sleep, but those hours had been some of the most restful he'd had in months. He hadn't dreamed of the war, or of his missions, until the pounding on the door reminded him of cannon fire.
"Juliana Rose!" came the impatient woman's voice.
"One more minute," she groaned.
"In another minute she will knock the door down, and the situation will be far worse," Neil observed.
"Whose voice is that? Who is in there?"
Something she heard must have finally penetrated her brain box, because she started like a frightened fawn and tried to sit, but ended up falling off the couch. Neil winced when he heard the thump. He probably should have caught her, but he rather thought he'd held her enough for the time being. She popped up again, pushing her tousled hair back from her face. She looked at him.
"Oh, no."
Then she looked about the room.
"Oh, no."
Then she looked at the door.
"Oh, no."
"Juliana Rose, if you do not open this door this minute, I will have this man. What is your name, sir?"
There was a muttered reply.
"This Mr. Goring, knock it down."
"Mrs. Dunwoody?"
Juliana asked more to herself than anyone else.
"It is I. You did write to me, did you not? And this is the welcome I receive."
Her gaze met Neil's, and there was the panicked fawn look again.
"She cannot find us here together."
Neil's brows drew together. "Do you want me to hide like some sort of rake?"
"No, of course not." She looked wildly about. "I want you to escape through the window." "With whom are you speaking, Juliana? I know there is someone in there with you. Open this door." "Just a moment, Mrs. Dunwoody."
"Who is Mrs. Dunwoody?"
"This is no time for questions."
She rose, grasped his hands, and yanked him up. His back protested, but he stood anyway.
"Jump out the window," she demanded, rushing across the room and yanking the draperies back from the rectangular window looking out on the street, obscured somewhat by a light fog. At least the rain had ceased.
She tried to push the sill up, her face turning as red as her hair as she strained.
"I cannot jump out the window." "This is the first floor," she said between clenched teeth. "You won't be hurt."
"What I mean is the window is sealed."
She slumped down, breathing heavily. She was dressed in her robe and nightrail again. The robe had come open, exposing the V of her breasts, and though Neil had been trying to keep his eyes on her face, all of those heaving breaths made it difficult to act the gentleman. She gave him a pained expression.
"Why is the window sealed?"
"I sealed all the windows whose locks were broken beyond repair."
"And what shall we do if there is a fire?"
"Break the window or use the door."
The pounding on the door to the parlour resumed.
"Speaking of breaking doors, you should probably let her in."
"I can't do that. Do you know who she is?"
"No. You said there was no time for questions."
Neil crossed the room. Apparently, he would have to admit the dragon, else he would be repairing this door later, and God knew he had enough on his hands with patching the leaky roof, building a rodent enclosure, and keeping slag away from Juliana. Neil opened the door. He spotted Mr. Goring right away. The servant looked as though he would rather be anywhere else. Behind him, every boy in the orphanage, in various states of dress or undress, had lined up to gawk at the newcomer. Neil had to look down to address her. She was easily the most petite woman he had ever met. He doubted she was 5 feet in pattens. She wore all black, and her small face looked up at him from under a tiny hat perched on a tower of white hair. He remembered reading that Marie Antoinette had worn towering wigs with birds and ships, and probably whole pleasure gardens depicted in them. This woman's hair was not a wig, but it was piled high enough that a nest of birds could inhabit it. He couldn't help but wonder how she kept the hat pinned in place.
"Who are you?" she demanded.
Neil had never been called charming. He was a soldier through and through, better with orders and strategies than charisma. Rafe was the charming one, but at that moment Neil would have traded places with his friend. He bowed, giving the gesture a flourish he'd seen Rafe make many times.
"Major Neil Raxall, at your service." He never used his rank any more, but he needed all the fortification he could in the face of this tiny tyrant.
Mrs. Dunwoody put her hands on her tiny waist.
"And what are you doing in the parlour with Lady Juliana, Major?"
The lady certainly did not have a small voice. Neil was fairly certain all of Spitalfields had heard the question. He held his hands up defensively.
"Nothing." Her eyes narrowed.
"Then why was the door locked?"
"For safety?"
Juliana rushed out of the room then, and Neil wished she had taken a moment to right her appearance. Not that he minded her rumpled hair or her gaping robe, but he minded Mrs. Dunwoody the Terrible seeing her thus. Mrs. Dunwoody's large green eyes widened behind her spectacles.
"Lady Juliana, what on earth?"
Neil glanced at Mr. Goring, who quickly looked at the ceiling as though something up there interested him greatly.
"Perhaps we should discuss this in private," Neil suggested.
Mrs. Dunwoody glanced behind her, seeming to notice the audience of orphans for the first time.
"Boys," she said, her voice full of authority, "march right back upstairs. I want you in the dining room in 20 minutes. Beds made, teeth brushed, hair combed, and dressed impeccably."
She clapped her hands.
"Off with you."
To Neil's astonishment, the boys scattered, running like squirrels when a carriage approached. He could have used Mrs. Dunwoody and the dragoons. As the boys retreated, he heard Charlie say,
"What does peckably mean?"
"I don't know," Robbie answered, "but we'd better do it."
"And you,"
Mrs. Dunwoody looked at Mr. Goring,
"do you not have duties to attend to?"
"Yes, madam, I'll see to them right away."
Then she turned her gaze on him.
"If you would, Major."
She gestured to the parlour. Juliana scurried in and Neil followed. Mrs. Dunwoody closed the door with a thud behind them.
"Now, I think we all know what happened here."
Juliana shook her head.
"No, madam, you do not. Nothing happened."
"Do not talk back to me, young lady. I may not be a woman of the world, but I am not a fool. A man and a woman alone in a locked room is bound to lead to frolics."
"Madam," Neil said as seriously as he could, "I vow there was no frolicking between Lady Juliana and me."
She glared at him.
"And even if I believe you, sir, what does that matter? It is the appearance of frolicking that is the problem. You have ruined the lady, whether you had your wicked way with her or not."
"My wicked way?" If he wasn't afraid she'd smash him over the head with her cane, he might have protested further. How fitting that he, of all men, should be accused of deflowering the lady.
"I am not ruined, Mrs. Dunwoody. Not that it matters. I told you that I will not marry. Regardless, Mr. Raxall did not compromise me. He arrived late last night and fell asleep on the couch in the parlour. I accidentally fell asleep, too."
Neil studied her expression. There was more to the story, but he would wait until he was alone with Lady Juliana to hear it. He rather wondered how the lady had come to be asleep in his arms this morning.
"Do you expect me to believe that?"
"It is the truth."
Mrs. Dunwoody looked at Neil, and he nodded his agreement.
"Very well," said Mrs. Dunwoody, seating herself in one of the armchairs. "I will accept that explanation for the time being, but we have not finished our discussion of this matter. However, I see there may be more pressing matters to discuss." "You wrote that you needed a teacher."
"Yes. Have you come to help?"
So this was Lady Juliana's former governess. It all made sense. No wonder she played the overzealous chaperone, and no wonder Lady Juliana had asked for her assistance. If anyone could teach these boys, it was obviously Mrs. Dunwoody the Terrible.
"I will stay and teach until you can find a replacement. I'm far too old and feeble to take the position permanently."
Neil covered his laugh with a cough.
"Are you quite well, Major?" Mrs. Dunwoody asked.
"Actually," he said, clearing his throat, "I have a few matters to attend to. If you will excuse me."
"Of course."
She dismissed him with a wave of her hand. A knock sounded on the front door, and Neil knew he was saved.
"What sort of matters?"
Lady Juliana asked, her eyes flicking to him, as if to beg him not to desert her.
"That is not our concern," Mrs. Dunwoody told her former charge. "Now, tell me what the boys have learned thus far."
Neil waved as he left the parlour, only to almost trip over the new cook, who had been standing just outside the room.
"Mrs. Koch, was there something you needed?" She put her hands on her hips.
"Yeah, if you want me to cook the breakfast, then I don't have the time to answer the doors."
"Of course, you needn't answer the door." That was his excuse for escape. "Where is Mr. Goring?"
"I don't know where that man went, but he went in a hurry."
Bloody hell, Neil knew exactly where Goring had gone.
"You have a guest, yeah?"
She nodded to Neil and then pointed to the entryway. Neil pointed to his chest as if to verify it was he who had a guest. When the cook nodded, Neil moved down the corridor and into the entryway and found Jackson suspiciously eyeing one of the buckets collecting rain. The valet was tall and almost gangly, with thinning black hair that he combed over the bald spot on the top of his head. He had large eyes that reminded Neil of a puppy's, along with a bulbous nose. But Jackson was good at his job. He did not dress Neil to within an inch of his life, as Rafe's valet did Rafe, but he made sure Neil was somewhat fashionable and that his clothing was well maintained. Jackson frowned with disapproval when he spotted Neil.
"I see I was right to come."
It had obviously been a mistake to stop at his flat the previous day before visiting the Draven Club.
"No, you were not. I didn't ask you to come here. I asked you to send clothing and toiletries."
A thud came from upstairs, and Neil realized it had been quiet for too long. Jackson's puppy eyes widened with pleading.
"Sir, I apologize for my behavior yesterday. I promise it will never happen again."
Neil moved toward the stairs.
"What behavior yesterday?"
Jackson loped after him.
"My gross inattention to my duties. Please do not dismiss me, sir."
Neil paused outside the drawing room at the top of the stairs.
"You mean when I found you napping?"
Jackson's face turned pink and he hung his head.
"It will never happen again, I swear on my mother's grave."
Neil held up both hands. "I have no intention of sending you packing." Another sound came from above, but this time it was more of a crash.
"Go back to my flat and sleep all you want."
Neil raced up the next set of stairs.
"This torture can't last much longer."
"I cannot do that, sir,"
Jackson said, racing after him.
"I've come to prove my indispensability."
Neil heard the shouts and the thumps from behind the closed door of the older boy's dormitory. Chester and James stood in the doorway of the younger boy's chamber, eyes wide with concern.
"What is this about?"
Neil gestured to the closed door. Chester shook his head. James just stared, wide-eyed. Neil lifted the latch, but the door didn't budge. The boys must have put something against the door to prevent entrance. He tried shoving it open with his shoulder, but made little progress.
"Open up!"
he pounded on the door.
"Open up, or I'll send all of you to a workhouse!"
The ruckus inside continued, and the door stayed closed. Neil pounded on it again.
"If you will excuse me, sir," Jackson interrupted. "Might I have a try?"
Neil stared at his valet.
"Why not?"
Jackson cleared his throat.
"The first boy to open the door will receive a shilling to buy a sweet."
Michael opened the door.
"Where's my shilling?"
Neil pushed past him and into the center of the room, where Billy and Robbie were circling each other, fists raised. Robbie's nose bled freely, flowing over his mouth and down his neck. Billy's cheek was red and his lip was split, but he was certainly winning the match.
"What the deuce is this about?"
The boys ignored him as Billy struck at Robbie with an impressive left hook. Neil stepped back between the boys and pushed them apart. Robbie lowered his arms immediately, but Billy resisted. When he tried to throw a punch at Neil, Neil used the back of his arm to push Billy up against a wall.
"You want to think long and hard before you try to punch me again, lad. Hit me, and I'll have you in a workhouse before noon."
"No, you will not,"
came Lady Juliana's breathless voice. She ran into the room, her cheeks flushed and her eyes wide.
"Robbie! Oh, no! Billy, do stop!"
The boys moved aside to allow her to enter. She rushed straight to where he held Billy.
"Let him go, sir."
"My lady," Neil said, "with all due respect, I believe I am better suited to handle this situation."
"I don't need your kind of help," she argued. "How dare you come in here and threaten to take my boys away?"
Neil gaped at her.
"This,"
he inclined his head toward Billy,
is no boy. He's practically a man, and he doesn't need a hug. He needs another man to tell him what is and is not acceptable.
I don't have to listen to you, Billy muttered. Let me talk to him, Juliana said.
No, go tend to Robbie. His nose may be broken. She glanced quickly at Robbie, then back to Billy.
Lady Juliana, Mrs. Dunwoody stood outside the room, her hand on her heart and her walking stick clutched in a small hand.
Listen to the Major. Not only is that other boy injured, but the little boys are scared. They need you far more than that one.
Juliana looked from Billy to Mrs. Dunwoody to Robbie. Jackson had given Robbie a handkerchief, and the boy had it pressed to his nose.
"I will tend to the young master," Jackson said, "if you want to see to the little ones, my lady."
"I'll help with the little ones," Michael said. "Then can I get my shilling?"
Juliana finally nodded to Mrs. Dunwoody and gave Neil one last look.
"We will discuss this later," she said, then moved toward the youngest of the orphans.
Neil nodded. "Count on it."
13. Julia calmed the younger boys, then ordered all the boys except Robbie and Billy to tidy their rooms and dress for the day. Mr. Raxall's servants had been more helpful than Julia might have anticipated. She had found time to change into a light green dress with fairer green piping, while Jackson tended to Robbie. When she had pulled her hair into a simple tail and come down to eat, the valet had informed her the boy's nose was not broken. It seemed he'd managed to restore order to the chaos of the morning, leading the boys to breakfast in the dining room in an orderly fashion, and then to the drawing room for their first lesson with Mrs. Dunwoody. Raxall had shown up at the end of breakfast without Billy, and when Julia had asked where he was, all he'd said was, "We'll discuss it later." Her stomach had cramped in fear. What if he'd already sent Billy away? What if it was too late and Billy was lost to her forever? Her hands had shaken so badly she could not manage to lift a spoon to eat her own porridge, even if she had been able to keep food down. When Jackson took the boys to the drawing room, Julia had her first moment alone with Raxall.
"Where is Billy?"
"He's thinking about his behaviour this morning." Raxall ate a piece of bread.
"He needs breakfast. He needs someone to give him some hard and fast rules. He's like an untrained soldier. Dangerous."
"Billy is not dangerous. He just needs someone to love him. He's been at the orphanage for years and seen adults come and go. His life has been full of unpredictability."
Raxall tried his porridge, nodded, and ate another spoonful. "Exactly. Now we need to give him predictability. If he breaks another boy's nose, there's a consequence."
"Thankfully, Robbie's nose isn't broken, just badly bruised."
"That's not for lack of trying."
"Listen, Mr. Raxall, you were sent here to persuade me to return home. I have told you that this is my home now. I have authority from the board of directors. You have no right to tell me how to raise the children."
The look he gave her was one she imagined he gave to the enemy before coldly bayoneting him through the heart. He stood slowly.
"Listen, my lady," Jackson cleared his throat.
"I am sorry to interrupt, but now that the boys are at their lessons, I wondered if there was somewhere I could unpack your things, sir, and perhaps ready water and your razor for a shave."
Raxall rubbed the bridge of his nose. "I have spare shirts in one of the servants' rooms. I suppose you could unpack there." Jackson stared at him.
"You have been sleeping in the servants' quarters."
"I haven't really been sleeping at all, but those are the only unoccupied quarters."
"I see."
Julia heard the note of disapproval and did not blame the man. Raxall did not belong here, but she was in the uncomfortable position of needing him. What made her dependence even worse was that she no longer needed him only to protect them from slag or to see to the roof repairs. She seemed to need his help with the boys as well. He was becoming the father the boys so desperately needed, except that Raxall, like most fathers she'd known, was destined to let the children down.
"I won't need a shave," Raxall told his servant. "I plan to climb onto the roof and assess the damage."
"The roof, sir?"
"I've been on roofs before, and if I'm not mistaken, Jackson, you have been around children before."
Julia cocked her head.
"You do seem to have a way with them, Jackson. I herd them like blind mice, but you manage to move them in an orderly fashion from the dormitories to the dining room and thence to the classroom."
She had no concerns about the boys now that they were ensconced with Mrs. Dunwitty. Her former governess was stern, but kind, and a gifted teacher. Despite their best efforts to remain ignorant, Harriet and Julia had always managed to learn something under Mrs. Dunwitty's tutelage. Jackson's shoulders seemed to straighten.
"I have had some experience with children, my lady. I am the oldest of 14.
14? Raxel sputtered.
"Your poor mother," Julia said.
Jackson shook his head, unperturbed.
"She is still strong as ever. She bore 19 children in all. 14 of us survived."
"I never knew this about you, Jackson," Raxel said.
"You never asked, sir."
"How are you with roofs?"
"Somewhat skilled, sir."
"Then I'll go alone." He looked at her. "If Mr. Goring returns, tell him I want to see him immediately."
"I will. Are you certain you should go on the roof by yourself?"
"I'm a man of many talents, Lady Juliana," and with that he strode out of the room. Jackson followed. Jackson called after him.
"Sir, when you have a moment, I do need to speak with you alone."
"That will have to wait, Jackson," he said, his voice trailing away. She wished the room did not feel so empty without him. She wished she didn't have the urge to stand outside and watch him up on the roof. Mostly, she wished she could send him away and never look at him again, because every moment she spent with him made her long for more. She had to keep busy. Clearing the dishes, she brought them to the kitchen and spent an hour with Mrs. Koch, making lists of foodstuffs to stock the empty larder. Julia knew she would have to write to the board and ask for funds. They would want to know what had happened to the food she had bought last month, and she would have to explain it had been pilfered. That would certainly not make her look a very good steward. What if the board denied her request? How would she find the funds to feed the children? She couldn't ask her father for more money, and the majority of her pin money was gone. It also looked as though she'd have to pay for roof repairs. With a sigh, Julia made her way to the parlour to begin her letters. If there was one thing she missed about her life in Mayfair, it was never giving a thought to money. As soon as she unlocked the parlour and stepped inside, Billy jumped to his feet. He might have bloodied Robbie's nose, but Billy had taken a few hits too. One cheek was red and swollen, and his lip had been split. Julia sighed.
"Oh, Billy, look at you.
Robbie looks worse.
Robbie is your friend. Why are you fighting him?"
Billy looked down at his scraped hands. Julia moved into the room and closed the door behind her.
"I don't understand. You and Robbie never seemed to have a problem before."
Billy's shoulders hunched.
"You wouldn't understand, my lady. You could try telling me."
He shook his head firmly.
"No, my lady."
"Very well. I imagine you are hungry. Go to the kitchen and tell Mrs. Koch I said to give you something to eat. When you've finished, join the other boys in the drawing-room with Mrs. Dunwitty."
"Yes, my lady. Is Mrs. Dunwitty the small lady with the poof of hair?"
She smiled.
"Yes, but one thing I learned from Mrs. Dunwitty is that though someone may be small in stature, that does not make them weak. Don't test her, Billy. You will not win."
"Yes, my lady."
He lumbered off, and she sat at the desk and put her head in her hands. Perhaps Robbie would tell her what had happened between Billy and himself. She lost herself in writing letters and detailing expenses, so much so that when Raxel pushed her door open, so that it thudded against the wall, she nearly jumped out of her seat.
"What is wrong?"
Blood marred the white of his shirt, trailing down one sleeve. She jumped to her feet.
"You are hurt, sir."
He glanced at his arm, seeming to discount the injury.
"It's a scratch. You, my lady, may not come away so unscathed."
"What on earth do you mean?"
She moved closer to him, her eyes widening as she saw how soaked the shirt had become with blood.
"Oh, never mind. You really must have that seen to. Where is Jackson?"
"I sent him to fetch my evening clothes. The Darlington Musicale is this evening."
Her heart seemed to thud painfully in her chest.
"I'd forgotten.
She'd hoped she would have more time."
"That seems a recurring theme. I also told you to leave Billy locked in the parlour.
I did leave him here, but I had work to do, and he was hungry and has his studies.
Raxel stalked toward her. Did you ever stop to think that there might be a reason I told you to leave him in the parlour?
Did you ever think to tell me what it might be?
He glared at her, and she glared back, but as she did so, a drop of blood fell from her hand onto the carpet. She'd had enough.
Sir, you will come with me immediately. I insist on seeing to your injured arm.
I told you it was a scratch, and I haven't finished the discussion.
Then by all means, we may continue it in my bedchamber.
He started to protest and then closed his mouth. Julia did not know if she should take that as a good sign or a bad. She did want to treat the wound before he bled to death before her eyes, but she wasn't certain she wanted him so eager to join her in her bedchamber. Or perhaps it was she whose heart beat a little faster at the thought of him in her room, alone and shirtless. "After you," he said, drawing her attention to the fact that she was still standing in the middle of the parlour. She clenched her hands together and walked past him, trying very hard not to notice how, without his coat, the tight fit of his trousers was more apparent, and his thin linen shirt did little to hide his muscled chest beneath. In the corridor she hesitated, not certain whether she should take the servant stairs or the main stairway. She decided on the main stairway so she would not have to explain herself to Mrs. Koch. All the boys and Mrs. Dunwoody were still at their lessons. Mr. Goring and Jackson were absent, which meant it would be her and Raxel alone together. She lifted her skirts and started up the stairs, feeling his presence right behind her. Since he'd eschewed shaving thus far today, he had a dark shadow on his jaw. His work on the roof had left a smudge on his cheek and several more on his hands. The overall effect was one of danger. The fact he stalked after her like a leopard hunting prey did not calm her nerves. Finally, they reached the second floor, and she led him into her chamber. She wisely left the door open as she rummaged on her dressing table for the kit she kept of basic medical supplies, bandages, strips of cloth, cotton, and spirits to clean a wound if need be. She found it, then turned to see him standing beside her bed, looking about her room with keen interest. Too late. She realized she had been in a hurry when she dressed this morning, after the embarrassing incident with Mrs. Dunwoody catching them in the parlour, and she had left all of her underthings strewn about. Not to mention her bed was unmade, and her night rail lay on top of the coverlet. His gaze met hers, and Julia swallowed at the heat she saw in his eyes. She had to say something, anything, to ease the tension they both felt.
"Take off your shirt."
Quite possibly that was not the correct phrase for the exact moment. He raised a brow, probably considering all the naughty things he might say next. She cut him off.
"I need to see your injury."
"It's not an injury. It's a scratch. What we really need to discuss are Billy and Walter."
"Walter was not even involved in the incident this morning," she protested.
"That's because he and Billy are working together." He moved closer, his gaze locked on hers. "For slag." She remembered the conversation she'd overheard between Raxel and Walter. Not Billy, too. She shook her head.
"Billy isn't working for slag."
"I can't prove it, not yet at any rate, but all the signs are there."
This could not be happening. These were her boys. Slag could not have them. "I won't let slag turn my boys into criminals."
"How will you stop him? It won't be long before these boys are bigger and stronger than you, and then they'll go where they like, when they like. I'm fairly certain Billy could best you."
"He would never hurt me."
She knew Billy, knew that underneath his aloof exterior was a boy who just needed to be loved. She had to find a way to reach that boy and to show him that she would love him. "My lady, forgive me. But I have fought with thousands of men and commanded hundreds. I know something about my own sex. All Billy knows is violence. He might not want to hurt you, but if you stand in his way, he will do what he knows best."
"And your solution is to condemn him to a life in a workhouse?"
"Never. It was a threat, but the idea behind it is sound. If he is a threat to the other boys, then you owe it to them to send him away."
No. Her chest tightened, and she struggled to draw a breath. I will never let you take him away. I won't allow you to take any of them. They are mine, and you can't take them from me.
To her shock, tears appeared in her eyes. Even if it's for the best, he asked.
It's best that they stay here with me. He was not Lanesborough, she told herself. Not Lanesborough. But it was too late. She could not calm herself.
He leaned down so their eyes were level. You are not Billy's mother.
I am the closest thing he has to a mother, and I will not allow you to rip him out of my arms as he cries in fear because he's being taken from the only people and the only place he's ever known.
She'd said too much. She knew it too late, and she pressed a hand to her mouth, but Raxel's shrewd gaze missed nothing. Instead of replying, instead of asking her what the devil she was talking about, he stepped back, turned, and walked to the bedchamber door. She closed her eyes. He would leave now. He would go to her father and tell the Earl to send footmen to drag her back to the townhouse or, worse yet, an asylum. Perhaps he'd even warn the board she was not sane enough to hold this position. She heard the door click closed and opened her eyes, but he wasn't gone. He regarded her as he leaned on the closed door.
Perhaps it's time I allowed you to tend to my injury.
She sniffled.
I thought it was merely a scratch.
Yes, well, even a scratch can become infected and fester if not properly treated.
She nodded. Were they still talking of wounds, or was he being metaphorical?
And then she forgot her name, much less worrying about literal versus figurative language, when he moved away from the door, pulled his shirt tails from his trousers, and yanked the shirt over his head. Neil had never been tempted to break his vow to abstain from coitus until he stood half-naked in Lady Juliana's bedchamber and watched her brown eyes darken with desire when he removed his shirt. She made him want to throw caution to the wind and take the chance that he might father a bastard. His iron grip had always been steady and solid, even when he had a woman naked and willing in his arms. He'd always been able to give and receive pleasure without that one dangerous act, and though some women tried to entice him, he was steadfast. Lady Juliana was doing nothing to entice him, and yet he felt himself harden. In his mind, images of her lying beneath him, crying his name as he drove into her, came again and again, wholly unbidden. He told himself this was not the time to give in to temptation. She was visibly upset. About Billy, yes, but about something far more traumatic. She needed a distraction and consolation. She did not need a man who could think of nothing but deflowering her. Her pink tongue darted out to lick her bottom lip in a gesture that was obviously innocent, but which fired his blood nonetheless. Abruptly, he sat on the bed and balled his shirt over the tent in his trousers, lest his arousal become patently obvious. That seemed to compel her to action. She gathered her medical supplies and placed them on the bed next to him, then poured water from the ewer into a basin.
"You are right, of course," she said,
her voice a little wobbly but growing stronger.
"The reason we came in here was to tend to your wound."
He glanced down at the scratch on his arm and resisted, pointing out it really did not qualify as a wound. Distraction was key at present. When she had recovered herself, he could bring up the topic of Billy again. As to the other matter she had mentioned, he was curious, but to ask her about it would be a mistake. He was already in too deep here at the orphanage and with her. He could not encourage confidences. He could not allow emotions to whirl about them and spin a web binding them together. Unfortunately, he was feeling some rather strong emotions when she knelt on the bed beside him and began to clean blood from his arm with a clean strip of linen. Why the hell had he sat on the bed? She had a chair at the dressing table. Why hadn't he sat there instead of this bed that conjured images of the two of them entwined together even before she knelt beside him on it? Some of the blood on his arm had dried, and she lightly gripped his arm as she attempted to clean it. He clenched his jaw in an attempt not to notice the softness of her fingertips, the swell of her breasts against the light green fabric of her dress, or the tempting fragrance of roses that scented her hair.
"Am I hurting you?" she asked.
"No,"
he said, not unclenching his teeth.
Why?
You seem rather tense.
Was it his imagination, or did she sound as breathless as he felt? He turned his head to look at her, then thought better of. If he looked at her, he'd only notice the way the light made her coppery hair look as though it was aflame, or the pale translucency of her skin, or the fullness of her mouth.
Stop it. Think of...
He struggled to imagine something or someone unattractive. Porter, think of the Draven's Club's master of the house. There was absolutely nothing remotely arousing about Porter.
There, that's clean. Now, where is the bandage?
She leaned forward to look for it, pressing her breasts against his bicep. Neil closed his eyes, but he couldn't imagine Porter's wrinkled face. All he could imagine were the soft curves of those breasts as they strained within the confines of the lace night rail. He gripped the bedclothes with his uninjured arm and could almost feel the silk of the night rail against his palm. Opening his eyes, he realized his hand had landed on the damned night rail. How the devil was any one man supposed to stand strong in the face of these temptations?
Here it is. She sat back again.
Neil thanked God, only her hands touched him again. His nose caught the sharp smell of spirits right before she pressed a cloth soaked in whatever it was against his scrape.
Bloody hell, he swore. You could warn a man.
She looked up at him, eyes wide.
Did that hurt?
Not so much as the straining of his cock, but he couldn't do anything to ease that discomfort.
A little sting, he said, his voice clipped.
I'm almost done.
He watched as she wound the bandage around his bicep. He was not about to take his eyes off her, not after she'd almost caused him to squeal like a child. She moved with grace and efficiency, and the scratch was covered in clean linen in no time. She tied it off, but having a difficult time making sure the knot was secure, she used her teeth to pull one end of the knot she made so she could keep the finger of her other hand in place. Good God, but he would embarrass himself in a moment. He could hardly stop himself from imagining those small, white teeth moving just a fraction to the left and scoring his bare chest. Unfortunately, she chose that moment to glance up at him.
All done.
Her smile faded when she saw the look on his face.
What's wrong? She asked.
I'm sorry, he grit out, leaning toward her and wrapping his good arm around her waist.
When she gasped in surprise, he said again,
I'm sorry.
His mouth took hers in a fierce kiss. She stiffened in his arms, her lips tight and unyielding. But as the kiss deepened, she became more pliant. Her body melted against his, and her lips softened. She returned the kiss tentatively at first, and then she was kissing him back, her passion as hot as his. He growled and pulled her closer, needing more of her, wanting all of her. But that didn't satisfy. He lifted her and hauled her onto his lap. Her hands dragged through his hair, and his hands held her waist and splayed upward until the tips of his fingers brushed the swell of her breasts. He waited for her to protest, but she only continued to kiss him, her tongue delving into his mouth and twining with his. And then, as though the decision was made for him, she leaned into him, and her breasts filled his hands. What was a man to do? He cupped them, moving his thumbs until they traced the points of her nipples through the thick fabric of her gown. He traced the nipples, still kissing her, until he felt them pebble and harden. With a moan, she leaned back and looked at his face. Her breath came fast and hard, and her face flushed when she looked down at his hands, moving in circles over her rounded flesh. She did not tell him to cease, and Neil had the impression that he might not be the first man she'd allowed this liberty. She was an earl's daughter. She'd been to balls and fêtes and soirées. More than one man had probably pulled her into a dark alcove to kiss her, then try for more. Her eyes closed briefly as his thumbs brushed her nipples.
You like this, he said quietly.
I shouldn't.
You were made to experience pleasure.
I have a house full of orphans to care for. I don't have time for pleasure.
She began to wriggle off his lap, which only made him want to keep her there.
You can make time.
No.
He had to allow her to pull away. He'd been raised a gentleman. He knew when a lady resisted, a gentleman released her. He also knew he would not have this chance again, and whereas before one woman was the same as another, now this woman was the only one he wanted. And of course, this was the woman who did not want him. Neil released her, disappointment surging through him. He hadn't expected to feel such fierce regret at having to let her go. In the past few days, he'd seen her frustrated, angry, amused, and nurturing. He'd also seen her aroused, and that was the look he liked best on her. He held his arms out, a gesture designed to prove he would not attempt to keep her against her will. Instead of pushing away from him, she sat motionless on his lap. Was it his imagination, or did she hesitate? Perhaps she was not so certain she wanted to be free of his embrace.
"Wait," she said, her voice quiet and hesitant.
Neil's heart began to pound, and he had to hold his arms at his sides to keep from wrapping her in them once again. She did not move, and after three thudding heartbeats, Neil swallowed.
"Wait."
She shook her head.
"I was right to begin with. Stop."
But she didn't rise or make any move to pull further away from him. Instead, her gaze met his. He saw a wariness there that he'd seen in her eyes when she'd looked at him before.
"Who hurt you?"
he said, thinking aloud, the words free before he could rein them in.
"No one," she said immediately.
"Did some man force you? Did he physically hurt you?"
His arms circled her, the gesture purely protective.
"Tell me his name, and I will see that he receives the punishment he is due."
She gave him a sad smile.
"Thank you, noble knight, but I wasn't accosted. There's no one who hurt me."
Neil could see in the way she shifted her gaze that she lied, and whatever it was she hid, that was the key to everything. 14. She wasn't being completely honest. She had been hurt. Her heart had been torn from her body and stomped on not once, but twice. But that pain, that injustice, was not of the kind he spoke of. He thought some man had forced unwanted attentions on her. That wasn't it at all, though she was not so innocent that she didn't know some men would take as much as they could if given a chance. Even gentlemen were not averse to demanding that pleasure bestowed be repaid.
"But you don't trust me."
She looked up from where her hands had fisted in the material of her day dress. She was painfully aware she still sat on his lap, painfully aware she should not be there, painfully aware of the hard length of him waiting to press against that moist, intimate part of herself if she only scooted forward slightly.
"Trust you how?"
"To stop when you ask me to stop, to release you when you say no."
Her cheeks heated. "We should not be discussing this." And yet she could not make herself move away from him. His arms still encircled her, and she loved that he held her. She wanted to move closer, put her head on his chest, press her lips against his bronze skin, because of one thing she was certain. He was absolutely magnificent. When he'd removed his shirt, her legs had gone weak at the sight of all that perfect golden skin. His shoulders were impossibly broad, his waist flawlessly tapered, his chest tightly muscled, and his abdomen taut and flat. He looked every inch the knight, the warrior of the storybooks.
"And yet you do not move away from me."
She might have moved away then, but as soon as the words were spoken, he leaned forward and nuzzled her neck. Small tendrils of pleasure curled through her. She sighed and put her hands on his shoulders, feeling the heat of him all but pulsing under her fingertips.
"Do you know why you don't move away?"
he asked, his breath hot on her skin.
"Why?"
she murmured, angling her head to give him better access to that one spot just below her earlobe. She would end this in a moment. She would tell him to cease and mean it.
"Because you like this. Because all day you take care of everyone else, and right now you have a moment to yourself, and you deserve pleasure. You need pleasure."
It was true. It had been so long since she had done anything for herself. Read a book, taken a walk, lay in a bed and slept all day. Her life was all duty and responsibility, to the children, to her father, to the board. Raxel's mouth moved over her skin so lightly and with such skill that she could not stop the shivers racing down her spine. She could have given herself to his lips all day. She needed nothing but the feel of his stubble tickling her skin and the brush of his mouth tantalizing her flesh.
"The children," she murmured,
"are with Mrs. Dunwoody."
His hands moved up her back, pulling her closer until she was pressed against the warm skin of his bare chest.
"And if she releases them?"
"We'll hear them." His mouth traced her jaw. "They are louder than a cavalry regiment."
His mouth took hers in a long, lazy kiss. Her breasts felt heavy and ached for his touch. She pushed them harder against his chest, but her need went unfulfilled.
"I should see to the noon meal."
"Let me see to you, and Mrs. Koch will see to the kitchen."
Before she could protest, not that she intended to, his hands cupped her face, and he kissed her with such a thoroughness she could think of nothing but lips and tongues and teeth. Her hands explored the long, lean planes of his back, holding on tightly when she feared she had grown so light-headed she might fall.
"Juliana," he murmured between kisses. "I like the way you say my name," she said. "You make it sound so exotic."
She always preferred Julia to Juliana, which sounded so formal. But when Raxel said her name, it sounded soft and sensual.
"Let me show you pleasure, Juliana."
Yes, that was what she wanted. More of this, more of him, more of those heart-stopping, head-lightning kisses that made her forget empty larders and leaky roofs and scheming crime lords.
"Just for a moment," she told him,
but she knew she was his for as long as he continued this persuasive assault. He pulled her even closer, and she felt the bulge of his erection pressing deliciously against the juncture of her thighs. Her skirts and his trousers were between them, but the feel of the material separating them did nothing to diminish the knowledge that he desired her. He wanted her, even after seeing her at her worst. His mouth continued to worship hers, and she wriggled on his lap, trying to relieve the ache growing between her legs. He groaned, and she stilled.
"Did I hurt you?"
"It's an exquisite pain," he said through clenched teeth. "I find that an apt descriptor."
"Exquisite pain. What does that mean?"
"I'll show you."
His hands circled around her ribs, coming to rest just beneath her two heavy breasts. With a slowness that made her catch her breath, his fingers skated upward until they caressed the dark green ribbon that lay just beneath her bosom. His hands traced her curves, stroking and cupping her, until her breathing had grown from quick to panting.
"Please," she said, her eyes widened. "I did not mean..."
He put a finger to her lips.
"Yes, you did, and I know what you want."
His hands went back where she wanted him, and then his thumbs moved toward the center of the orbs, brushing lightly over her nipples. She jumped as sensation flashed through her. His fingers caressed the hard nipples again, circling them until they grew harder.
"More?" he asked.
Of course there was more. She knew there was more. It was simply that she had never allowed any man to go any further than this. To do so now, with this man who made her feel what no other man had ever made her feel, was surely madness, and yet she would be mad to tell him to stop. She was beginning to understand what he meant by exquisite pain. She yearned and ached, but she never wanted that sensation to cease.
"Trust me," he said.
His hand moved to where she'd pinned her bodice, and he slowly removed first one pin, then another. He stuck them into the coverlet on the side of the bed where they would not be lost, and he moved to unpin the other side of her bodice. She couldn't trust him. She couldn't trust any man. She knew what they were. She knew they were selfish creatures who cared only for their own pleasures, but as this man lowered her bodice, she watched his gaze turn reverent. His fingers brushed lightly over the swell of her breasts at the edge of chemise and stays.
"Your skin is as beautiful as it is soft," he murmured. "Let me see you."
No man had ever seen her. She'd never imagined she would allow a man that liberty. After all,